Good morning. So it's really a privilege to speak here today. I always love this congregation. And I'd like to thank Reverend Mike Moran and Mr. Eddie Carroll and all the First Unitarian for extending the invitation to me. My name is Parker Wilson. I'm a doctor of clinical psychology and a psychotherapist in the Denver area. I teach clinical psychology and counseling psychology. I've done a lot of work with grief and loss. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the dynamics of those things for a bit. Historically, this time of year really triggers a lot of sadness and depression in many of us. Winter is pretty cold and it's relatively dark. Family concerns press on us around the holidays. Our sense of obligation rises. This year in particular, our economy is quite bad. Things are dwindling. Many of us don't have enough money. Most of us don't have the kind of money we thought we would. At the close of the year, all of us are unsure as to what the next year will bring financially. Such shifts in the world around us often make us feel like we've lost something. Even if it's just our peace of mind, we still experience it as a loss. We tell stories about our loss, I know our feeling of loss, usually about how unfair it is. We often adopt a why me attitude about our feelings of loss. We armor up in an effort to protect ourselves. We usually tell stories about how this won't happen to me. And we frequently try and avoid and dismiss those it is happening to. But even in these transitory negative circumstances, these shifts in the world around us, we suffer anyway, even if those things aren't there. When our economy is great and our jobs are well paid and secure, even when we're going to have Christmas in Paris, France, instead of Paris, Texas. Even when we have plenty of money and even some money to burn, we're not really satisfied and secure, are we? Not deeply. We're still somewhat anxious and stressed. We know that every moment of great achievement and so-called happiness is ultimately fleeting. After we get that big promotion, the elation of it is gone after some time. After we marry the perfect partner, the honeymoon always ends. We still find ourselves prone to becoming sad, lonely, frustrated. Sometimes we even become depressed. What does this all mean? I mean, what does it point to in us? This tendency. I think it shows us that underneath all of the changing circumstances of our day-to-day realities, there are some inescapable and overarching losses that characterize all of human life. These are things that are slowly and progressively, we're losing them all the time. The first one that comes to mind is getting older, aging. We're so uncomfortable with age, really. It's uncanny, actually. I mean, have you ever asked a small child how old they are? How do they respond? Do they give you a really definite, concrete answer, like I'm 4 or I'm 5? No, not usually. The usual response to such a question is I'm 4 and a half, or I'll be 6 next month, right? There's a strong sense of discomfort in young children about their age, something that says I'm too young, I don't like it, it's better to be older. Like there's something wrong with this. It's like a sense of vulnerability, almost. And we hate feeling vulnerable. We can't stand it. This is even present in teenagers. It's not that I'm 16. That's not the thing. It's that I'll be 17 in 3 months. That's the thing. Right? Just discomfort. Usually in our 20s, we don't have much trouble. We feel comfortable there. But when 30 hits, some of us freak out a little bit, around 30. Most of us freak out to some extent at 40. 40 is just kind of uncomfortable. I turned 40 this year. It's kind of uncomfortable. It's like I'm more connected to loss at 40 than I was at 30. It just feels vulnerable. It's harder to deny aging. when we reach 40. It becomes more difficult to squirm out of it, to wiggle out of it. And when was the last time you heard someone in their 50s refer to themselves as middle-aged? What's that all about? Comedians actually joke about this. Like, 55 is middle-aged if the average life expectancy is 110. But it's not, right? We laugh at this joke, but we walk around living our lives from the very center of this delusion. We believe in it strongly. We call it positive thinking or some other such psychobabble. And we believe we're doing ourselves a favor. And even into our 60s and 70s, most of us stay anxious. In fact, I was recently talking to a friend of mine about a question about a health issue. And I needed to know her age. So I asked her the question, "How old are you?" I noticed that I felt nervous asking this question. Almost like I didn't want to know the answer. Like the answer was a little scary. And of course it wasn't the answer that scared me. It was all of my stories and judgments about what it'll mean for me to be in my 60s. Like, that's what I came eyeball to eyeball with. That was really the scary stuff. And despite the fact that this woman is among the wisest and most balanced people I know, when I asked her that question, fear came into her eyes. Just very briefly, she only hesitated for a moment in responding. But it was there, vulnerability. So how can we be truly happy when the source of our happiness is transitory, always changing and disintegrating? If youth, beauty, health, wealth, these are the sources of your happiness, then your peace of mind will always be coming and going, ebbing and flowing, up and down, off and on, present and absent. You will exist on an emotional roller coaster. You will easily become depressed, and then you will easily mistake the absence of depression for genuine happiness. We must make this mistake pretty routinely. But the sensation of pain is not the same as happiness. When wealth is present, you will desperately cling to it, gripping it for dear life, dreading and frantically afraid of losing it. When your wealth dips or leaves, you'll feel deeply unsettled, depressed less than, unfairly deprived. The world will seem cold and hostile to you. You will feel as though someone pulled the rug out from under you. From this place, we can begin to connect to the mentality of the Wall Street guys who kill themselves when the various markets tank. It's desperation. After 40 years on this emotional roller coaster, you will find yourself very desperate, disoriented, nauseous, even decidedly dissatisfied. And what about sickness and death, the second and third usual universal sufferings we all experience? These are tough. These two are there no matter what else is happening in our lives. How are we to understand these experiences? When a woman goes to her doctor and is told that she has a fatal disease, her entire life changes in a split second. At first, she's terrified and overwhelmed. But if she's courageous enough, her terror will soon dissolve and reveal a serenity. If she stays with it long enough, it'll dissolve. Though she still feels like a rug got pulled out from under her, she finds some freedom and even a joy in that sense of groundlessness. I've seen it many times. She drops the stories about the past and the future and begins to live in the present, just in this very moment, which is all we really have. She makes friends with her sense of loss, and she is finally able to connect to the beauty of winter. And what about death? Many of us have never seen death, or we see it only very rarely. When was the last time you actually saw a dead body? Has it been months? Years? What about the time before that? We tend to keep ourselves so sanitized about death. And why? It is as common as birth. Christ's greatest miracle centered around his physical death. Among the Buddha's greatest teachings was the lesson on how to die, which he gave while he was actually dying. How hardcore is that? Researchers study the effects of death. Psychologists work with grief and loss on a routine basis. Why should we be so afraid of death, living in avoidance and denial of it? Fear of death, A lack of genuine acceptance disconnects us from the preciousness of our lives. This makes us hurt. It makes us yearn for connection. Why shouldn't we become more curious about death? An experience some have called the most intimate, vulnerable, and important experience in life. We humans are a strange breed, really. The entire world around us is fundamentally impermanent, yet we walk around projecting stability and permanence onto everything. Nothing in this world is stable and everlasting, yet we invest our energies in making ourselves see it that way. We believe it. We create false beliefs based on skewed perceptions. And what is that but a delusion? This is why it hurts so badly. This is why someone we love dying so often feels like a Mack truck hitting us at 80 miles an hour. When we speak to ourselves and each other, we use words like always, never, forever. It's in our music. It's in our movies. We use these words like they are real, like they mean something. You can check this yourself if you dare. Just wear a rubber band around your wrist, and every time you use the words always, never, and forever, give the rubber band a snap. My bet is that you'll miss half the times you use the words because it's so automatic. It's just on autopilot for us. That's how deep it is. I'll also bet that the rubber band will be off your wrist within a week to prevent, like, serious tissue damage. Think of what you could learn about yourself from such an exercise. When we make promises to ourselves and others, we don't stay down long enough to realize that always, never, and forever are fairy tales. We don't pay attention to how the world actually is, how it shifts and changes constantly. We choose not to notice its impermanent nature. Right now, your body is changing, your mind is ebbing and flowing, the earth is rotating, the clouds above us are moving, our solar system and galaxy are spinning and expanding. Right now, in this very moment, hundreds of people are dying, and hundreds more are being born. Your own day of birth has come and gone. Your day of death, however, has not yet arrived, but maybe tomorrow it will. Maybe it will. That's the thing about death. It's absolutely certain, but the when and how of death are unknown to us. Instead of allowing that uncertainty and groundlessness to open our hearts, to inspire us to stay, we usually use it as just another excuse to close off, to armor up, and to withdraw. This is why we hurt so badly and so often. We don't see life as it actually is. Our perception is flawed. Thus, we're always running afoul of reality. A pilot with flawed perception will quickly find himself in a lot of pain. This is true for us as well. We want so badly for life to be solid and permanent, yet its nature is exactly the opposite. So instead of correcting our perception and learning to fly right, as it were, which we can actually do, which it is possible to do, we choose to remain stuck in delusion and misapprehension. We think we're helping ourselves by remaining stuck. Maybe that's the unspoken belief. But we're fundamentally afraid, and so we go to sleep again. We choose to tell our stories again. We choose to superimpose those stories onto the people, places, and things around us. And we choose to believe in their permanent reality with the full force of our minds. And your mind is a powerful thing, probably more powerful than you realize. And this is how our fear and our pain and our disorientation deepen. When the great spiritual masters and adepts, Christ and Buddha among them, instruct us to live life in the moment, why are we so incapable of doing that consistently? It's so hard. I mean, I can be present and mindful for a time, but invariably, I get all caught up in and identified with my thoughts and emotions and judgments and opinions and beliefs and stories about my past and future and blah, blah. I just get lost in it again. I become identified with fear. I realize intellectually that the past is gone and that the future doesn't exist and that it may never exist. But still, I get caught up in my fears and stories about them anyway. I cease being present in the moment. And like a child whistling in the darkness, I begin creating stressful and disconnected alternate realities in my mind. This is my most resilient and entrenched psychological habit. It's on autopilot. But, and this is the crucial question, what if we decided to make a different choice in response to our fear? What would happen if we began committed to waking up, to living from a deep and profound awareness of impermanence? If we became less reactive to our fear of impermanence, we would treat everyone as if they were on their deathbed. We would be patient, kind, generous, compassionate, and more invested in their well-being. And we wouldn't be wrong either, because they very well might be on their deathbed and just not be aware of it. No one knows. If we became curious about our fear, we would be better off. The next time you feel afraid, instead of running, denying, numbing out, deflecting, becoming angry, projecting, or shutting down, simply slow down and become curious. This is all Buddha and the other masters are really saying. If we become curious about the nature of our fear, if we slowed down and became less reactive, we would just feel better. Becoming curious about our fear creates a natural desire to stay with it. In the end, we learn that happiness is not other than loss. Happiness is not relief from loss. Happiness is a profound acceptance and incorporation of loss, so that the very duality of happiness versus loss ceases to have any meaning at all. When this occurs, we no longer prefer one over the other, and with no preference and no expectation, there is no fear. It's not possible. Now examine for a moment. All of this talking that I've done up here about aging, sickness, and death, how has your mind responded? Have you become a little sadder? Do you have some small desire to, like, tune me out? To withdraw? If so, I invite you to become curious. Right now. In this very moment, underneath all of this reactivity, if you look closely enough, with enough mindfulness, you will find your fear. Asking analytical questions about fear is good to do. Why am I afraid? What am I afraid of? And so forth. But even more important than this is just having the willingness to look into your fear. Just courageously experiencing your fear, observing its sense of overwhelm and anxiety. This is the true teacher. Just mindfully observing and deciding to stay with your fear, to see where it goes and what it becomes when you're not adding to and subtracting from it. This is very difficult to do, make no mistake. It takes tremendous mindfulness, compassion, practice, patience, concentration. But in becoming that courageous and that still, you will eventually learn to become more fearless. You will progressively cut through your fear. You will eventually see through it altogether. You will spend less time mindlessly acting and reacting from fear, hurting yourself and others. You will no longer be so caught up in your stories about the meaning of being young and old, sick and healthy, or alive and dead. All of these stories exist in the ego, in the I, the me, which is who we think we are. The ego's perception is cloudy and short-sighted. You will eventually see through your ego as well, your own concept of self. And when we see through ourself, as so many masters say, right? When you see through yourself, well, what do you see? Do you see some sort of ethereal non-self? I don't think so. Instead, what you see is everyone else, all of your brothers and sisters around you. And because they have all created this world in which you have gained such freedom and peace, your heart will break with an immutable desire to help them find their freedom and peace. Then you will be skillful, you will be fearless, you will be finally and forever awake. Thank you for your attention, and I wish everyone a wonderful New Year. Thank you.